If you put your effort and concentration into playing to your potential, to be the best that you can be, I don't care what the scoreboard says, at the end of the game, in my book, we're going to be winners.
We be the untraditional, metaphorically medicinal, investopedia, rockin' decibels, money be our ritual. One condition though, you learn the fundamentals, make it your ritual in the country or municipals. Learn your balance sheets, check those spreadsheet, Excel's regression analysis, what's the earnings potential? Cash flows, 10Ks, leverage ratios, we got those. Lessons for investors, students, and professors for the self-directed or advised, getting started or quite wise. All are welcome to apply. We got the dictionary, articles, and FAQs, explainers, simulators, got a team on the news. Since 1999, we've been riding this money train. The Express is on the tracks. Make it rain, make it rain. Welcome back and welcome aboard. And are you ready to go a little bit higher? Just a little bit higher? Because we are starting out the month of April with fresh new record highs for the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials. The S&P 500 just closed out its best first quarter gain in 5 years, gaining 10.2%. 2019's first quarter gain was 13%, if you're keeping score. The Dow 30 gained 5.6% in the first quarter, its best first quarter since 2021, and the NASDAQ fired up a 9.1% gain.
Pretty good.
You're right, Larry. That was pretty good. The S&P 500 ended the month of April with a gain of more than 1%, making it the fifth straight month of gains over 1%. According to the good people at Bespoke Investments, that's happened 12 times since World War II. It's what happens after streaks like this where it gets interesting. Five out of those 12 times, the S&P 500 traded lower in the next month, but not by much. 6 months later, the market was lower only once. 1998 was that year, and we know what happened in 1999. We don't want a party like that. 1 year later, after a five-month win streak, the market was higher 12 out of 12 times. The average gain was 14%. Trends in motion tend to stay in motion, especially over longer time horizons. But it's worth noting that last quarter's price surge across the stock market has made it pretty expensive. The trailing price-to-earnings ratio for the S&P 500 is 23 times, and the forward PE is 21 times expected earnings. Both are historically high, and investors better hope that the E, or earnings in this equation, catches up with the P, or price. In other words, it's time for companies' fundamentals to show out. The good news, according to Fidelity's Jurian Timmer, is that it looks like it's starting to happen. The consensus forward earnings per share estimate for the S&P 500 is growing at a 10% clip on a quarterly basis. Corporate profits are getting better and better, which means the PE ratio for the index will stop rising as the market grows into its price. And that leads us directly into our big three for the week.
Circle it.
Number one, these higher highs have not come without some market divergences along the way. Our pal JC Peretz at All Star Charts points out a few of them in his great newsletter.
There is a great disturbance in the force.
JC said divergence, Emperor, not disturbance. And if you look at the divergence between the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Dow Transportation Average, you'll see a big old divergence in Dow theory. You remember Dow theory, right? Our guy, Charles Dow of Dow Jones, conceived of it at the end of the 19th century. Dow theory stipulates that the market is in an uptrend if one of its averages advances above a previous important high, accompanied or followed by a similar advance in another corresponding average. Well, that's not happening. The Dow Industrials have been advancing, but the Dow Transports have been retreating. The transports have shippers like FedEx and UPS, as well as other container companies, airlines, and railroads. If the economy is allegedly getting stronger, you'd think the transports would reflect that. They are not. Another divergence is in small caps, notably the Russell 2000, which holds companies with market caps between $2 and $10 billion. The Russell 2000 index does not have requirements for the companies in it to earn any money. There's a lot of meme stocks in that index and a lot of risk. The S&P 600 index, on the other hand, requires companies to post solid track records of earnings to be included in it. You got to put up or shut up to be in the 600. And the S&P 600 has yet to make a new high. And one more. High beta stocks, aka risky stocks, they have been solidly outperforming low volatility stocks, lower risk stocks. That's worth watching as markets keep making new highs. And number two, would you like a little more speculative froth with your cappuccino? We've got that in crypto land again. Bitcoin is nearing new all-time highs again. There's a halving coming up soon, and those spot Bitcoin ETFs are all the rage. But I'm not talking about Bitcoin, the OG crypto token. It deserves its seat at the table. I'm talking about dog with hat. Yes, I said dog with hat, and it's a real crypto token. I guess, except like Dogecoin, it's a total joke. check out the white paper on Dog with Cat, which we'll include in the show notes for your amusement. Don't expect complicated equations or algorithms and promises about a decentralized future where this token enables seamless cross-galactical transactions. As it says across the white paper, in quotes, "I mean, bro, it's literally a dog with hat," end quote. And it has a picture of a Shiba Inu Dogecoin dog in a hat, and it's literally at a 52-week high, making it one of the most valuable, in air quotes, crypto tokens out on the market today. And number three. You'll have to excuse my friend Cuckoo Bird. He's a little amped up on those crunchy, chocolatey Cocoa Puffs, and he's going a little nuts because prices for the cocoa bean have risen faster than Bitcoin over the past few months, and that is saying something. Cocoa already passed the all-time record high it hit way back in 1977 of $5,400 per metric ton right before Valentine's Day. But last week, prices for at least one of the futures contracts topped $10,000 per metric ton, just in time for chocolate Easter bunnies. Cocoa prices have more than doubled in the first 3 months of the year and more than tripled in the past 12 months. Before you go and blame Count Chocula and the nice people at General Mills, you might want to look into climate change. Extreme weather conditions and crop disease have severely impacted production in West Africa, specifically the Ivory Coast and Ghana, where about 70% of the world's cocoa comes from. According to the International Cocoa Organization, heavy rains and flooding late last year, followed by intense El Nino winds and a drought, led to the spread of black pod disease, and that destroyed a lot of the cocoa crop. Trucking the beans out of those flooded farms was extremely difficult and costly. Arrivals at ports in the Ivory Coast and Ghana have declined 28% and 35% respectively since the start of this season, compared to the same period last year, according to the ICCO. You know what that means? Higher prices at the candy store. Hershey's and Mondelez, which makes Cadbury, have been hiking prices while other companies like Mars are playing the shrinkflation game with their bars and promoting other less chocolatey bars like hazelnut. Let's get set up for the week ahead, and we're coming off an extended weekend right into a brand new quarter. April is historically one of the better months of the year for the stock market, so let's see if that trend continues after a really strong first 3 months of the year for most asset classes. We'll get a double dose of key economic news and data this week, with inflation numbers out for March with the release of the Consumer Price Index on Wednesday, followed by the Producer Price Index on Thursday. Those were a little hotter than expected in February due to higher energy prices, so let's see if that trend continued in March. And the labor market is back in the spotlight with the March job numbers out on Friday. Forecasts are for a gain of around 215,000 jobs, down from 275,000 in February. But it's the unemployment rate we want to keep an eye on. That crept up to 3.9% in February. Ahead of the payrolls report, we'll get the job openings and labor turnover survey, the JOLTS report, as we call it around here, for February. How many jobs are available, and how many people are quitting their jobs? That's always a key indicator of worker confidence. We'll also get monthly vehicle deliveries for March from all the big automakers this week, but the spotlight is on Tesla as usual. The OG EV maker has resorted to deep discounts to sell its most popular sedans in the US, and sales in China are slowing. A lot of competition from Chinese and Korean EV makers out there like BYD and NIO, who are making cheaper cars for those markets. And the battle for the future of the Magic Kingdom will reach a fever pitch this week at Disney's annual shareholder meeting. It pits Disney CEO Bob Iger and his board against activist investor Nelson Peltz and Triad Partners. Peltz and his firm have acquired a $3.5 billion stake in Disney and have been pushing for seats on its board and a realignment of the company's focus to maximize profits from streaming and a reset of its strategic priorities. From 50,000 feet and above, the U.S. economy appears to be relatively stable. GDP is expected to grow more than 2% this year. The unemployment rate is 3.9%, or within the range of what the Fed considers to be full employment. We've had wage increases the past couple of years. That's rare. And inflation, it's kind of cooled way down. But if we swoop down closer to the surface, there are some troubling trends that could turn into real problems in the not too distant future. The problem with those problems is that, like an avalanche, you don't see them coming until it's too late. Claudia Sahm has made a career out of digging into those cracks in the economic fissure on the macro and micro levels. She's a well-known, often cited economist with policy and research expertise on consumer spending, fiscal stimulus, and the financial well-being of households. She's worked at the Fed and as a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors in 2015 and 2016, so she knows how policy really works from the Oval Office to the kitchen table. She's got an opinion column on Bloomberg and a terrific Substack called Stay at Home Macro. And for all you Investopediacs out there, if you're wondering why her name sounds familiar, it's because she created the SOM rule, one of the most important recession indicators out there. And we are delighted to have Claudia on the Express this week. What a thrill. Welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Well, since we have you here, let's let you explain the SOM rule, which you really created as a policy tool, but we would love to hear your clean explanation of it.
Right. So the SOM rule, which is a recession indicator, not a forecast, but it says we are in a recession, was a supporting actress in a policy that I had put together that really was the star of the show. And that's when a recession starts, send out stimulus checks automatically, right away, and base it on economic conditions, not on the politics. To be able to actually have a proposal, have legislation like that, you got to have an indicator that says, send them out. And the SOM rule, which I did not name after myself, it was my way of taking the unemployment rate, which is something we all follow. And it is why we fight recessions. Millions of people losing jobs is why recessions are so horrible. So I used the unemployment rate. It needed to be simple. I want this to be in legislation. It's in legislative text. It's not in legislation yet, but we're moving that way. It needed to be simple, and it needed to be highly accurate. Congress won't want to send out hundreds of billions of dollars and then go, oops, no recession. I mean, people would be probably fine with this, not the deficit hawks, but most people would be okay with getting a check. In any case, I sat down, those were the criteria, the SOM rule, which I take the 3-month moving average. It's so important if you're following economic data, not to overreact to 1 month. I feel like in some sense, that's probably going to be my legacy from this, like teaching financial markets the beauty of 3-month averages. So I take the 3-month average of the unemployment rate, look at the most recent value of that series, compare it to the low of that series over the prior 12 months. If the increase is a half a percentage point or more, that's not a lot, right? If it's a half a percentage point or more, we are in a recession. We're in the early months of a recession. Since the 1970s, this has had a perfect record in terms of it turns on early in a recession and it does not turn on outside of a recession. And you go back to World War II, and it's pretty close. But since the 70s, kind of the most recent recessions, totally accurate. That was a design feature that was really important to me. And I mean, I didn't invent the idea that increases in the unemployment rate are a bad sign, and even modest ones. To your avalanche analogy, the labor market, we have a very big economy, $25 trillion plus, millions upon millions of workers. When things go south, they start slowly. It's like the snowball rolling down the hill. But once it gets going, and the snowball does not have to be that big, it is very hard to stop, and we end up in an avalanche, right? So the SOM rule triggering at half a percentage point is just the beginning. The most mildest of recessions, like in 2001, it continued to rise and in total rose 2 percentage points. It's often closer to 4 percentage points. I mean, that's a lot of workers out of work. And that's a labor market that isn't giving opportunities to the ones who keep their jobs. And wages slowed up. Like, we all workers suffer in a recession. The very beginning is your best shot to, we can't stop them, but it's your best shot to make them less severe before we have an avalanche.
So was it something you were studying when you were getting your PhD at the University of Michigan about recessions? Were you a recession buff that you decided to dig into this? And then I also want to know, how weird is it to be a policymaker and an economist and have a rule named after you that you didn't actually name yourself? Is that just strange, people talking about you, the name, the rule all the time? What do your parents think about this?
Everything about this is so strange. What I was an expert on, I was drawn to economics to work on economic policy. I was taught straight out of undergraduate, economists can do good in the world. And to me, doing good in the world was always about doing good policy. When I got to the Federal Reserve in particular, I showed up in the summer of 2007 as one of the leads on consumer spending. My first year was absolute crazy. right? Like in trying to learn.
Yeah, nothing going on but the beginning of a great financial crisis at that time.
The very first forecast that I was the lead, you're always supported as a newbie, right? But the one I was considered the lead on the forecast was January of 2008. And that was when the Bush administration started getting going on the stimulus checks, the 2008 stimulus checks. And from that point on, I spent not just in my policy work, because the Fed doesn't have an opinion on what Congress does, but they need to understand what the economic effects are so monetary policy can work around the edges. We never talk about that in public, right? Like we never tell people like how good Congress's stuff is, but we need to know that. So that was my job. And then I also did all my research on it at the time. I studied the 2008 stimulus checks, Obama's making work pay tax credit, which was kind of spread out money, the payroll tax cut. And my research, part of it was trying to figure out what was the best. In terms of being named after me, I was at the launch event. My recession indicator, my proposal was in a bigger volume that was put together by Hamilton Project, the Brookings Institution, and Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Every chapter was something we put on autopilot. And I'm sitting at the launch event, and in like the first session, the somber roll. I was like, whoa, what's going on here? This is not, and I was horrified. And then after the event, I went to talk to Christy Romer about something, you know, in my talk, and, you know, because she was at the Council of Economic Advisors at the very beginning under Obama. And after we talked, I was like, Christy, I am so embarrassed. Like and she looked at me and she's like, Claudia, she's like, you have got to own this. Any man would own this. And so I was like, okay, Christy's a hero. So I was like, I'm going to listen to Christy. What I've learned since then, and this even came up very recently, owning it means not just explaining it, helping policymakers, helping the general public understand it. It also means defending it, like keeping an eye on it. People have been applying it to states recently. And I'm like, oh, no. And so finally, I wrote a Bloomberg piece about it because I couldn't control the narrative and I have other it's been kind of strange. And there are days where I was telling a friend the other day, I was like, I'm thinking about changing my last name. I was just like, I'm not sure I wanted this, but it's been truly, I feel so privileged to be able to have this platform. And in the last 2 years, it's been very important because I have been out of consensus in saying, no recession is here. It is not imminent. And we do not need a recession to bring unemployment down. And it's been very lonely out in the wilderness explaining this, but I kept saying the labor market is too good right now. It may not last forever, but I really was trying to be a voice of reason and calm. And I think the somber will help me have the credibility to do that.
Yeah, well, we need you on that wall. So please stay on that wall. Hold the line. It is important. All right, let's bring it back to the U.S. economy today. Headline numbers look okay on a month-to-month basis. But as you say, you got to look at a three-month timeline at least to see a trend. But you've been pointing out trends on your terrific Substack and on Bloomberg in the labor market that do not look that healthy. What are those specifically?
First, I look to the labor market as like, how are we staying out of this recession? There has been, over the past few years, a very virtuous cycle between the labor market is strong, the paychecks are out there. In fact, the paychecks, even at the bottom, have been rising faster even than inflation. And then the American consumer comes out there. Now, I cover consumers at the Fed, and bless their hearts, if they have money in their pockets, some people have to spend it to make ends meet. But even people got a lot of money, we like to spend money. So as long as you keep that, the labor market strong, the consumer strong, you really have a buffer, say from the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates high, or if we go into a period of pulling back on fiscal spending, like kind of go austerity, and yet nothing can hold out forever. So I watched the labor market extremely closely just to see any cracks in there. And there are some now, more than we've seen in the past few years. And it makes sense. Like, we are putting a lot of pressure on the American consumer, people that have to, you know, take out mortgages, have credit cards, small businesses that need loans, because interest rates are high. So I keep an eye on it. My base case remains that we stay out of a recession. Inflation continues to come down to reach the 2% target that the Federal Reserve has set. And yet there's risk in the labor market. And what has, among many things, but what has disturbed me the most in the commentary, and even out of Fed officials, not all, is being very cavalier about the risk to the labor market. They're like, oh, the economy is so strong. We have the luxury of time. We can wait to cut interest rates. And I'm like, I'm not sure you got as much luxury of time as you think. And if nothing else, I want to hear them talk about the risk. Our risks are not one-sided. And it makes me nervous. You know, if you've got a blind spot, that's where a problem comes from. And again, once that snowball of the labor market starting to come apart, if you wait until it has really picked up steam, you have waited too long. And at this point, because inflation is so low, the Fed's target, core inflation, taking out food and energy that can really, you know, give you head fakes, it is within a percentage point of the target. It has come down. If we have a recession now, it is a completely unforced policy error. And the fact that people aren't aware of it makes me like more nervous we might get that.
You focused a lot of your research on household finances and economics. That's where the real feel of the economy plays out on a daily basis, at the kitchen table, at the grocery store. And the majority of households, or a lot of them, are not feeling very confident given inflation and given high interest rates. The shareholders and homeowner classes have had a great few years, and the macro numbers look pretty healthy, but what's the disconnect between the headline numbers in the economy and the real feel at the kitchen table?
All of the work that I do is grounded in data. So as a macroeconomist, there's this misconception, or at least it's a misconception if it's directed at me, that, it's the big numbers and you don't care about the people and blah, blah, blah. And I always tell them, I said, look, those macro numbers, we go out and we survey people and businesses. And so all I'm doing is reflecting back to you what a representative group of Americans is telling us. I had written a piece earlier, because it was last fall, about most Americans are better off financially than they were before the pandemic. I mean, this is just amazing. But if you ask people their wealth, I mean, the increases in wealth since 2019 are just like, they're historic, right? It's just amazing. And up and down, income distribution, every demographic group you can imagine. Now, I mean, the rich people start out with a lot more wealth, right? And if you don't have a lot, it doesn't take much to get a big increase. And yet, typically, they're totally left behind, like after the Great Recession. You ask them about their jobs, more people are employed, people have gotten raises, and that, like, the ones at the bottom is just, again, they didn't start out with a lot, but they made a lot of gains, and that's good. You ask them about their spending, inflation adjusted, their spending. Inflation is not good, but if you can walk out of the store having paid for what you needed when you went in, that, as far as I'm concerned as an economist, that's what matters. I want you to be able to feed your kids. It's fine with me if you walk out of the store and you're angry. I walk around angry all the time. So when I look at how people are doing financially, not all, most Americans, and actually this time, that most Americans includes many further down, like working class. I mean, with the poor, there were policies in place. A lot of them aren't still there anymore, but we put a lot of relief out to help people through the worst of the recession and early in the recovery. Now, I write this piece and I've written about it at Bloomberg. I've spoken a lot about, but why are people so angry? Why, if you ask them big picture, hey, how are you doing financially? Or what do you think about the economy? Like, they're really gloomy, like extra gloomy. Like, there were sentiment surveys, which I haven't worked with a lot at the Fed. There was a period, it's gotten a little better, but there was a period, it looked like 1970s gloomy. I was like, no, this is not the 1970s, right? So something else is going on there. I've written about, I think some of it is a trauma coming out of the pandemic. Like, this has been a roller coaster and not a good one. And over time, it's going to take time for that to heal. It's going to take time for us to see, oh, our wages, our income, our paychecks, we got past that inflation, right? It's just time heals at least a lot of wounds. And so I point to the pandemic. I've also written about the possibility that social media has been an amplifier. I mean, if it leads, it bleeds has always been a thing in the news. People just like, I mean, for whatever reason, we just eat up negative, bad stuff. Unfortunately, social media has been a way to really blast it out and to blast out very negative perspectives.
All right. Future cast doubt for the next few years, if it's even possible to see past the election. This is not a political question, but how will the U.S. economy evolve from your perspective, from a labor productivity and growth standpoint? Where are we now? What kind of an economy are we today? And where will we be in a couple of years?
Really positive developments in train, if we can pull it off, right? The holy grail of economic prosperity is productivity growth. And that's not about, well, if we damage people in a recession and recovery, then we can damage the prospects of productivity growth. What we have seen in recent years is productivity growth, the amount of stuff that any person or any bit can produce, right? We have seen that really pick up. Now, productivity growth, it's the holy grail. And sometimes we think we see it and the data revise, or like we see it a little bit and then it disappears. One thing that I learned at the Federal Reserve, listening to the, you know, the elders of the FOMC is, well, because during the Great Recession recovery, the Federal Reserve, our forecast, the staff forecast, we kept marking it down because recovery was so slow and so painful. And it's like, well, trend growth is just not what it used to be. And, you know, being told by one of the Fed officials when we brought in this forecast, and he's like, a quarter percentage point on productivity growth is such a big deal, right? Because it adds up over time. So it's like anything we can get is a good thing. So we have seen, again, some signs in the data, and yet even more important, we've seen some technologies both take hold, like work from home has really opened up some people on the margins who needed flexibility with work, be able to participate. Women, prime age women's employment rates are at an all-time high. Workers with disabilities, you know, I mean, there's just a lot that's opened up from work from home. And it looks like where we're at is likely here to stay, maybe much to the chagrin of some employers. But that's important. The labor market has been very strong. And then, you know, there's been endless discussion about artificial intelligence and some of the new capabilities. And honestly, I'm a macroeconomist, so I'm never like totally optimistic. But I do see the ability to automate out jobs that are bad jobs, right? That really like nobody wants to do. They're very monotonous. They're not, you know, kind of fulfilling careers and giving people an opportunity to go to better jobs. And a lot of the quote unquote better jobs that are out there, I see artificial intelligence more as a tool than a replacement. I mean, computers have made a lot of people a lot more productive. People are going to be necessary for a long time at work. And yet with a little extra help, again, you can take out some of the monotonous work and you can really amplify people's workers' capabilities. And that's what productivity is.
All right. If you were graduating from college today and you were considering a PhD or career in economics, where would you focus your efforts today thinking about the future? Let's go out on this. You know, Investopedia is a site built on our terms, our finance and investing in economic terms. We have to know Claudia Somm's favorite economics term that is not the Somm rule, which, as you say, you created as a policy tool. But what is your favorite term?
So if I go back, setting aside my, you know, what I do every day as a macroeconomist and going back to basics, you know, for people coming out and starting their careers, an economics concept that I think is very important are opportunity costs. Right. It may seem that we have limitless time at the beginning of our careers, but that's not true. Right. Anything you put your time and energy into, there's something else that you could have. Right. And so just understanding trade-offs and what you're giving up to do what you're doing. And it may totally be the right decision. It's just respecting the fact that our time is our absolutely most precious resource and we should treat it that way. And you should enjoy stuff. I mean, like opportunity cost doesn't mean you always pick the, like, you know, eating the vegetables. It could still be going out with friends and doing something fun. But just being aware that you have limits on your time and make choices that feel right to you.
We love that term. That is a great term. I use that all the time with my daughters. Claudia Somm, she has a terrific opinion column on Bloomberg, a Substack called The Stay at Home Macro. You got to check that out as well. And the creator of the Somm Rule, although she didn't name it that, it was named after her. So delightful to have you on the Investopedia Express. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And this week's term comes to us from the crypto patch, and it's Bitcoin halving. You've heard us talk about it on this train before with Rick Adelman and Matt Haugen, among others, but we're getting closer and closer to that Bitcoin halving event. It could be any day now. And just in case you need to refresh your recollection, according to the world's oldest and greatest finance and investing education website, a Bitcoin halving event occurs when the reward for mining Bitcoin transactions is cut in half. Halvings reduce the rate at which new coins are created, or mined, as they say with software in the case of Bitcoin, and thus they lower the available amount of new supply. This was all part of the original code behind Satoshi Nakamoto's design for Bitcoin. The other key part of this, according to the founding protocol, is that just 21 million Bitcoin will ever be mined and in circulation. So it has a ceiling on supply, and it's going to get harder to mine. That's very different than gold and gold mining. At Bitcoin's launch in 2009, miners received 50 Bitcoin per block, but that reward was reduced to 25 in the first halving in 2012, then it was reduced to 12.5 in 2016, then 6.25 tokens in 2020, and it's scheduled to drop to 3.125 coins in this upcoming halving event. Every time a halving event happens, usually every 4 years or so, we see a lot of price volatility with Bitcoin, but lately it's been doing a lot of climbing as we head into this particular Bitcoin halving. Thanks, as always, for riding with us this week, and special thanks to Claudia Somm for climbing aboard the Express. It's not every day you get to talk to an economist who has a rule or principle named after them, and she's been doing some really important work. We'll link to Claudia's Substack and columns in the show notes, along with all the other reports we cited in this week's episode. Find those wherever you ride the Express, and a very, very happy Financial Literacy Month to you and yours. It's always Financial Literacy Month here at Investopedia, but we're always down to take it up a notch in April. Follow us across all social media platforms at Investopedia for lessons, explainers, and tips on how you and your family can get smarter about money. And check out our Financial Literacy Resource Center at investopedia.com/financial-literacy. We live for this, and we'll talk again a little further on down the line.